Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Paula Saunders. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, exactly.
All right. Yeah. Paula grew up in Rapid City, South Dakota, not too far from where I am right now in Iowa. She is a graduate of the Syracuse University Creative Writing Program and was awarded a postgraduate Albert Schweitzer Fellowship at the State University of New York at Albany under Schweitzer Chair Toni Morrison. Her first book, The Distance Home, was long listed for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize and named one of the best books of the year by Real Simple. And the book that we're talking about today is her second novel, or at least second published novel, Starting From Here. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Paula.
Thank you so much, Monica. It's really nice to be here, and thank you for having me.
So that is actually an interesting question. Was The Distance Home really the first novel you wrote, or only the first novel you published?
Well, that is a really interesting question because it was both, but then not, because I wrote it. I wrote it many years ago. I wrote a version of it many years ago. I worked on some of the stories in it when I was in graduate school. I was working on some of that material too when I was studying with Toni Morrison. And I did not publish it. I actually had two children and I kind of kept working, but I just didn't feel like I could. I just wasn't one of those people who could work on my writing and at the same time be a mother, and I was also teaching. There was just kind of too much going on. So what fell away for me was the writing. And after my children were grown and I was teaching at a small kind of private school, and I was teaching Little House on the Prairie to these about 13-year-old kids. And it was so fun. We were having such a good time. And I thought, you know what? I can do this. I could do that, you know, that kind of language. And I was loving it and having such a good time. And I thought, I'm going to try again. And then I wrote The Distance Home. And then I published.
Okay. So in the first version of it, I imagine, were you writing on computer back then? Or was it long enough ago that you were writing by hand or on a typewriter?
There you go. I was writing on a typewriter then I was writing on a typewriter where you could follow a little bit of the print.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I was writing on a big computer, like huge, an old Eagle computer. They're not even around anymore. So it was older equipment, but it got up to the computer age.
And of course, back then, if you were going to submit for publication, it was a completely different process, too. You had to make photocopies or print out this entire manuscript, mail it, pay the $2, $3 of postage to mail it, and then wait and wait and wait for some kind of response, which you might get or you might not. And do you wait till you hear back before you send it to someone else? Or do you go ahead and do you give them a certain amount of time and then just give up and send it to someone else?
I remember that so well. That's so funny, Monica. Oh, my goodness. I do remember that. Yes, I do. It's a strange memory. I wasn't very good at submitting my work. I liked doing the work, but I didn't like the process of submitting it. So I didn't submit very much. And that was one of the things that my teacher, Toni Morrison, told me, submit. But I didn't like to do it. So I kind of got over that hump when I was older and felt maybe a little more settled and a little more confident.
So having Toni Morrison as your writing teacher, was she famous at that point, or was this before she became so famous?
Actually, this was right at the time that she had just finished Beloved.
Wow.
So I was working with her while she was in the middle of publishing and promoting Beloved, at least for the first year that I was with her. And that was really astonishing. I mean, she was such an astonishing, like magnificent presence. She really was. So, and also for me, because I was very lucky and grateful that she liked my work, she was really a generous reader. And I mean generous in the way that she would really tell me what she thought. It wasn't that she was, you know, sugarcoating anything. It wasn't like we were going to be friends. It was just, this is my true deep belief about what you've presented to me. And I felt like that was real generosity. That was a real true generosity. And I really appreciated that from her.
So even, you know, at the time, you were aware maybe how fortunate you were to have her as a teacher.
Yes, I was very aware of that. I'd read Sula. Sula had already been published at that point. And I'd read her first book. Why is the name escaping me? Anyway.
The Blue Eyes something, or was that later?
Yes, no, that was the first one.
That was the first one. Okay.
Yeah, so yeah, I'd read those, and I was just crazy about her work. Wow. So she was something magnificent, really.
Did you apply to that program because of her?
Oh, that's really funny. You know, I was teaching comp for a summer at Syracuse University because I was just finishing my degree, and so I needed a job. So I was teaching comp just for the summer. They'd asked me to teach incoming, like upper level high school students coming into Syracuse University. And so I was doing that, and I wandered out into the hallway one day, and there was a poster on one of the bulletin boards about this fellowship. So I applied to it, and that's how I ended up with it. I think she took there were three fellows that she was working with, and it was a 2-year fellowship. And yeah, wow. Lucky me.
So Starting From Here is a novel about a young girl who leaves home from a small town in the Midwest and tries to become a professional ballet dancer. And so, I mean, based on kind of the details that you're writing in here, I'm guessing that you have had some experience with this yourself.
Yes, that's a very good guess. Yes, exactly. I write even for my first book, I write fairly autobiographically. So yes, all of this, or most of it are things that I have experienced myself. I did leave home early to study ballet. My story follows somewhat along the lines of Starting From Here. And I'm very acquainted with all of what happens in the book, for sure.
Right. And the time that this book is set in is the 1970s. Am I getting that right? Okay. And
yes.
So she leaves Rapid City and goes first to, I believe, the Houston area, and then to Colorado.
Phoenix.
Phoenix. Okay. And right, and then to Colorado, and then eventually makes it to New York. And you know, one of the blurbs on here described the book as a page turner, which I agree. It is. It's like when I started reading it, I just wanted to keep reading. And that's not necessarily something that you would normally say about a kind of a coming of age book. But it just, I felt so much empathy for this girl. And yeah, so like you said, it's fairly autobiographical, but are there, it makes me, you know, how close to you is she?
Oh, she's very close to me for sure. Actually, I actually made a decision early on in my first book because they are connected, and it's not necessary to read the first one to read the second one. But I did make a decision early on that I needed to change from a first person narrator to a third person narrator. That was also a Toni Morrison revelation. She didn't tell me to do that, but her comments on what I had sent her made me realize that I needed to do it. And I needed to do it because the one character, and this was for my first novel, The Distance Home, the one character I couldn't seem to penetrate was the character Renee, who is me. So there was something about penetrating that character in the first person that I could not do. Just maybe because I'm a fairly private person and it seemed to me too revealing. But I think, yeah, if I so once I put it in the third person, I was able to kind of open her up a little bit and explore a little bit more. And then also, like you said about the piece of a lot of empathy for that young girl. I have a lot of empathy for that young girl, and I have a lot of empathy for young girls coming up in this culture in general. I really do, and maybe because of the kinds of things that I've been through as a young girl, and because I went through them, and Renee goes through them in the book on her own, without the support of her family. And is still kind of having to navigate all of the treacherous waters of being a young adolescent girl. So there's that, and that empathy developed in me, maybe mainly as I got older.
She, like you said, she was alone because she was far away from home. But thinking back, because, I was similar age at a similar time in life, and I'm not sure that many girls at that point in time, because the world was changing a lot. And I don't know that for many of us, our mothers were very present in helping us navigate those changes.
I could see that. I can
E
see that.
yeah, even when they were there, in the same home.
Exactly. I can totally understand that. I think it's funny because when we think about our mothers, I don't know if this is true for you, but this is Eve in the book. I think about her and I think about my mother and how our mothers at that time were themselves navigating so much. I know my mother really was a housewife, dominated by her domineering patriarchal husband. And she was into this idea of a liberated woman. I mean, thank God for her. She really had the idea that women should have freedom and they should have their own job and they should make their own money. And she was such a, vibrant, vivacious person. She wanted loose of that trap. And I think she couldn't really get loose of it. And so, they were navigating that, and we were navigating turning, coming up from being girls to being young women. Those are both difficult kind of situations.
Absolutely. And during the age of, sexual liberation, how you say, so the rules were changing kind of right before our eyes, and we didn't know what they were.
And I think our mothers didn't know what
Our
they
mothers
were.
didn't either. And I also think that even like the generation before, or and many generations before, where it was so adamantly, it was so taken for granted and so adamantly kind of imposed that good girls didn't do that, but they did.
But they did.
But
That's
they
right.
did. And so in some ways, the fact that suddenly we're in the situation where, well, I think everybody else is doing it. But we don't talk about it. We didn't talk about it, which is different, I think, from like my kids' generation. And I don't know about today, but where girls maybe talk to their friends about, you know, sh do they want to do, what are they doing with their boyfriends? What do they want to do? Do they, you know, they might have, where we didn't talk about it at all with each other. At least I didn't with my friends. And so I always thought, well, I'm the only one doing it. Until one day, and I remember my senior year of high school, sitting around with a group of girls at lunch, all of whom were honor students, you know, went to church, you know, good families, and they were say we were trying they were trying to estimate how many girls in our class they thought had had sex.
Right.
You know, and they were saying 80, 90%. I'm like, oh, well, if they all think that means they're all doing it. And I didn't know.
Yeah, that's right. And it, you know, I mean, I think one of the things about this girl, Renee, being on her own is that, you know, she's moving from place to place. So she doesn't have that group of friends to kind of, no matter what happens, talk or not talk, maybe friends monitor each other's behavior, you know? So she's a little bit more vulnerable to the male half of this equation. So, you know, I'm not quite sure how young girls navigate that, but I mean, we know with the Epstein files that these girls are still vulnerable to that. And it was really interesting. I heard a woman who had been a victim of Epstein, and she was saying that she had been in New York. She was 18 or 19, and she'd been a ballerina. And then, you know, she was rounded up by the Jeffrey Epstein people, and she was like, maybe you can't understand, but I was younger than my years. And I was like, oh, I know you. I know you because the ballet world is so cloistered and you're working so hard to achieve a very singular goal. So you don't have that exposure to friends and what's normal and what's not normal, what's expected from men, what's not expected from men, what's out of bounds. So in that way, her solitude kind of works to, I don't know, highlight those things or put a spotlight on those kinds of issues for young girls.
And well, there's also the fact that as a dancer, you're used to being touched. You know,
Yes.
you're being lifted, you're being your teacher's coming around and moving you're taking your arm and moving it and probably touching you in places that like I would never have someone other no one would touch me.
Exactly.
And so it might be more difficult to understand where the boundary should be.
Yes, I think that's really, really an astute observation. I really do. And I also think that as a dancer, you're so used to using your body to accomplish something, you know, so your body doesn't feel like private property. It feels public. It feels
Yeah,
like
it's on display all the time.
exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. So different kind of world.
So I just found it kind of appalling that the people that she stayed with, the adults, didn't act very adult. Nobody was looking out for her.
I mean, that's the truth. There was no one looking out for her. And so the one thing I think that she learns is that she has to look out for herself. But that is impossible as a 15-year-old, impossible as a 16-year-old. You can only try, you know. And so the one person who was very kind to her was the Colorado family. They were very kind. And
They were
so that,
weird. They were very weird, but they were very kind.
they were very weird, but they were very kind. And I'll tell you, I mean, with the autobiographical nature of this, to this day, I appreciate that, that kindness, so.
But then the next place that she stayed, and I don't want to, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but that adult was did not do her any favor, was kind, but did not do her any favors.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Right. Because, she wasn't really there to be a guide.
No.
You know,
She was
no.
fairly young herself, probably, and
Exactly.
it kind of reminded me of the summer I graduated from high school when I was 17. We took a trip from there was a trip to Spain. It was with a college, and we were part of this college group. Then there was a high school group, and there was a college age group. And because we had graduated, we were in the college age group. Several of my friends and I, and our parents had let us go because our Spanish teacher, who, looking back, was probably on the verge of senility, had convinced them that this was really well chaperoned and we'd be taken care of everywhere. And the chaperone that we had was our high school guidance counselor, except she was really there for the high school kids, and at some point they all left and we had no chaperones whatsoever because we were with the college group. But even while she was there, she was like 26, I think. She wasn't that much older than we were. And she, like the first night that we're in Spain, the first day we decide to try and go from the campus into the town, and the bus won't stop. And so she convinces us to hitchhike.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. That's incredible.
Yeah. And there were five of us, so we split into two groups. And so I was with the group that didn't have any, there were no adults in our group, and some strange guy picks us up, and we don't know where we're going. We don't know how we're getting back. We don't know where we actually are supposed to end up. It could have been horrible. And as it ended up, I mean, I kind of had to make the guy drop us off somewhere, and just finally just said, just leave us here, just leave us here. Because, and then we do end up finding her, and there was another older student who was there in place of her younger sister who got mono and couldn't go. So there were these two 20-something-year-olds, and then there were the three of us who were 17, 18. And we ended up meeting up with them, and again, these guys try to pick us up, and she's like, yes, let's go with these guys. And we end up going out in the middle of nowhere with these guys. And I almost started walking back to campus, which I had no idea where it was. I had no idea, but I was so scared, and I just acted strong enough that they took us back. But I had to fight one of the guys off my girlfriend because he wouldn't let her go. Yeah. And this counselor thought all that was fun. She thought it was all in good fun. So yeah. So
Well,
this reminded me very much of this character in your book.
that's right. I mean, that's where that comes from me too. This is these kinds of experiences are what, in this particular culture, these kinds of experiences are what our young girls go through in whatever way they go through them. And then we have an attitude that turns it around on them. Like you don't want to be that kind of girl or like whatever it is. We have an attitude that takes this kind of really dangerous passage that these girls are going through and flips it around on them so that if anything happens, it's their fault, and it starts at about 13 and it goes all the way up to 25, I mean, all of these things that we see right in front of our eyes. So, I'm hoping that I'm really happy to hear that story of yours and that this book evoked that story from you because I'm hoping that it like, yeah, let's think about these things. Let's talk about these things. I think it's important, and I think we need to really understand the passage of young women more than we do.
I tell grandchildren who are in their early teen years. If you're ever in a situation where you feel uncomfortable, call me. I will come get you. No questions asked. Now, they're not in the same state as I am, but I have a friend who's near there. I will send him. He will come get you. No questions asked.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what young people need is that kind of support. And also they need the kind of not just that physical support, because that's a beautiful thing to give, but it's also they also need that kind of mental, cultural, like in the cultural psyche, we need to give them that support through that time. You know, I really believe that. And you know, I have a real soft spot for young women
Now,
because I know it's hard.
when you were in that situation, being on your own at such a young age, did you feel like you were grown, in some sense, like you were grown up and could handle everything? Because I did sometimes feel like I could. Did you feel that way too?
I did, and I feel like I think people kind of feel that way all the way along. I kind of felt like that when I was five, I think, you know. I don't think that's changed much all the way through. You know, I have a big scar on my chin because when I was about four or five, maybe I, you know, decided that we needed to, me and my neighbor friend needed to have a tricycle race down the sidewalk, you know. So it was just, I was just always somebody who thought I knew everything. So, yeah.
I looking back, I have some situations where it's like, why didn't people offer me advice or help or something? And I realized it's because I acted like I already knew what I was doing. Like I
You know,
acted like I had it under control, so even when I didn't.
I think that's pretty human quality, actually. Yeah, I do. I think that's a pretty, actually a good human quality. I don't think it's a bad one.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Paula Saunders, author of Starting From Here. How long did you work on this novel?
Oh my gosh, that's a big story. I worked on it about 6 years, but I worked on it in a kind of an interesting way. I started with a plan that I would make three books, that this would be a trilogy, you know, that Distance Home, Starting From Here, and then whatever the next one is. But because it was pandemic, I started this book and I just kept going and going. So I basically wrote both the second and the third book. But then I understood it really didn't work. The books didn't work like that. And I needed to split them in two. So it took a long time, but I have a lot of material now for the third book that I'm hoping to get to once I'm finished with, you know, this book. Yeah.
Which is launching this month in August of 2025, correct?
Right, August 26th,
Yes.
it comes on sale.
And when was your first book, The Distance Home, when was that published?
2018.
Okay. So that's you said the same character. So what was Renee in that book?
Well, that's interesting because that book has a totally different tone. That book changes point of view so that you go through the whole family. And it actually goes up to the deaths of most of the people in the family because it goes into the future like that and comes back. But Renee in that book is young. She is up to the age of 15. And at the very end of the book is when she's leaving home to do this book. Yeah.
So
So
was
it.
her brother a bigger part of that book, Leon?
Her brother's a little bigger part of that book. Yes, I believe so. And yes, it goes up to the completion of Leon's life period as well. So.
So, because I've had a lot of empathy for Leon as well, who is not doing too well in life through most of this book. He's gets in a lot of trouble, has addiction issues and so forth. And I don't know if this is what you were trying to say, or but it felt to me like if they had only just let him dance.
You know, that's a really interesting question, and I think that you've kind of hit on something, because I think the first book is much, you'd get a much deeper understanding of Leon.
Okay.
Yeah, but I do think that if they'd only just let him be,
Yeah.
you know, like if he wanted to dance, fine. If he didn't want to dance, fine. All of these things, you know, he was Leon, you can tell from the first book, especially, I think also from this book, was a very kind of tender soul and was very affected by all of the things going on in this difficult household. So, yeah, I think it would have been wonderful if he'd been supported.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what
Yeah.
I'm
I think
thinking.
is that, it's interesting, male ballet dancers have a whole different journey than female, but it no less problematic in a way, because even though it may be easier to become there's less competition to become a male ballet, professional ballet dancer, but there's still a lot of obstacles for
Yes.
most young boys.
Yes, I think so. But you know, I think not in every culture. That would be my thought. And now I don't have any like supporting material to kind of bring up behind that.
Like
But
in
that
Russia,
is.
for example, it might,
Yes,
yeah.
exactly. Other cultures have a different idea of men dancing. And you know, when I look around the world, you see these traditional dances that men do that are so beautiful and so strong and really accepted by the community and like and cherished and welcomed by the community. So I just feel like here we've lost a lot of that feeling of community, and I think dance has a lot to do with community. So, you know, men and community, and you know, you look at Greece and Turkey and different places like that, there, even New Zealand, and you know, you look at these beautiful men's dances, and I just think, what have we lost here? We've lost so much in losing that version of masculinity, you know,
Yeah, or
it's
even
gorgeous.
Native American.
Yes, exactly, right,
Yeah.
exactly. So we've lost something, and I think it's I think we suffer from it, and I think Leon suffers from it, you know, whether it's dance or just being a sensitive person in a culture that doesn't really tolerate that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Paula, would you like to read a little bit from Starting From Here for us?
I would be really happy to. I thought I would start with the second chapter and just read a little bit. So now, by the second chapter, we know that Renee has left for Phoenix. That's about as much as we know. It's the beginning of the book. So, you know, we know she's left for Phoenix. Leon used to be a dancer. He's not dancing anymore, but Renee is still dancing, and she's been sent away to kind of make something of herself, as it said. So, I'll start in chapter two. A street ran by the house where she was staying in Phoenix, the house where she lived, the house where Eve and Al were paying good money for her to be. She didn't know what street it was, or what part of town it was in, or whether it followed a river or led to a highway. The house was in the country, or nearly in the country. At least there weren't any stores or other houses nearby, not that she could see. It seemed like maybe there was a railroad. At night, she imagined a freight train running right across the street, which she knew it didn't do. But it was definitely in the country, because there were lemon trees in the back and grapefruits and limes, plus a stone walkway that led to a little cottage where a grandmother lived, though Renee had never seen her. There have to be neighbors somewhere, she thought. Maybe way down the road where the cars disappear. But she was too young to drive, and the parents at this house never continued down the road in front. They simply turned left out of the driveway, rounded the nearest corner, and went straight ahead onto a street that was empty, but for large warehouses set off in dusty fields dotted with sparse bunches of what must have been cactus. And suddenly, instead of far-off jagged mountain peaks like back home, there were low-slung strip malls popping up, multiplying, coming to line both sides of whatever thoroughfare they'd ended up on. Chapter 3. All her life she'd been told she was beautiful. In summer, the sun streaked her hair with gold and sprinkled her nose with pale freckles. And her mother said she was beautiful, and her grandmother said she was beautiful, and everyone she met seemed to comment on some aspect of her appearance, her dark blonde hair falling down the length of her back or woven into two long braids, her long legs and lean build, her dark brows and long lashes, her blue-gray eyes and Cupid's bow mouth and sweet smile. Well, isn't she a picture? Isn't she a beauty? Look out, ha ha ha, people would say, winking at Al or giving Eve a look of warning. And she was all right. She was good looking for sure. But no matter that everyone seemed to agree that a girl should be at least pretty enough to attract a stranger's attention, she could see now that for her, being pretty was going to be complicated. Because the dad at this house in Phoenix, who was thin and hairy and supposedly an orthodontist, though he never seemed to go to work, sat every night in his chair pretending to watch television as he snuck sidelong glances at her in her white cotton nightie. Every night after she'd changed out of her ballet clothes, he trained his eyes on her as if she were the fox and he'd gone a-hunting, scratching his head and thighs with abandon, enormous flakes of dandruff raining onto his back bathrobe as he ogled her through thick Coke bottle glasses, grinning and blushing. He's taking time off, the mom told her quietly one morning, seeming to be both apologizing and attempting to explain. Though Renee hadn't asked why the dad sat in his chair day and night like that, she'd been wondering. He had a heart attack last spring, and he's very weak, the mom whispered, pouring milk into a serving pitcher. And strange as he was, Renee felt sorry for him, not just because of the heart attack. She could see how his whole life must have been lonely. So she figured that under the circumstances, she shouldn't mind if he looked at her that way, piercing the thin white of her nightie with his big round eyeballs. But she did mind. It bothered her. She'd only brought the one nightie, since there were other more important things she'd needed to pack when she left home. And it was white, not sheer, but not sheer either. Still, the mom's explanation clarified one thing, and Renee began to understand why they'd agreed to let her live with them here, wherever this actually was, in the first place. Despite the blooming succulent garden, the hardy fruit trees, the meandering pink stone walkway, the lush green vines winding up to the awnings, with the orthodontist spending whole days in his leather recliner in front of the television, they likely needed the money even Al were sending. The mom was a tall German-looking housewife who kept her hair in a long, smooth roll at the base of her neck, ear to ear like a croissant, and maintained a constant cheerfulness, wearing a grin that wasn't really a grimace, though it often seemed to Renee that it might be. She kept to an internal code of conduct and had a simple way of being nice, while at the same time making you notice that she wasn't losing her temper. But the grandmother, who lived in the little cottage at the end of the pink stone path, just beyond the grove of citrus trees, was only for the real children, their children. A younger boy, Heinrich, called Henry, and a girl Renee's same age, Galliana, called Gally, who was in both Renee's ballet class and her class at school. Catching sight of Renee in the school hallways, Gally would lean into her circle of friends and laugh into her hand, clearly whispering about Renee's tall knee highs and too long uniform skirt, since the rest of the girls at Mother Mary Ignatius wore shoes with no socks in defiance of dress code and skirts hemmed up to just under their bums. She'd perform the gesture even when the other girls didn't join in, even when it caused them to look at her skeptically. And she applied variations of the same at ballet class, pulling girls close to make side-eye remarks about her new roommate, about the way Renee's leotard fit low and flat around the tops of her legs and high around her neckline, like some dancer from the olden days, or how Renee pinned her two long braids across the top of her head for class in what Renee's own grandma had called a golden crown, but which too easily suggested the name Gally made sure Renee overheard, Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm.
Thank you. That's Paula Saunders reading from Starting From Here. So Renee's under a lot of pressure to make something of herself. When you were, did you feel that pressure too as when you went away to become a
Oh God,
dancer?
yes. Oh God, yes. Yeah, nothing but.
Nothing but, so then, I mean, at some point, did you become a professional dancer?
I actually danced as an apprentice with Harkness Ballet in New York City. So
Okay.
I got just to the doorway of becoming a professional dancer. Yes.
And then at some point you stopped.
I did.
How were you able to break free?
Oh gosh. Well, that's kind of my next book. You're gonna have to
Okay.
have me back. Yeah.
I understand. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering then when you did this fellowship with Toni Morrison, did you feel that pressure again to make something of yourself as a writer?
That was a very different thing. I think that, yes, I did want to be a writer. But that was so I by that point, I had the support I needed in me, in my husband and family, and developing growing family at that point. And I was just pregnant with our first daughter during that fellowship, actually. But I had the support I needed, and I didn't feel that pressure of, we have so much pressure to either win or lose. I don't think I felt that so strongly then. I just felt the desire within me to kind of do what I was doing. And mainly, the desire to write well and to learn as much as I could about it. So different.
Did you said you weren't, you were teaching and you were a mom, and so the writing fell aside, but I mean, obviously you didn't lose what you had learned because your writing is amazing. So were there ways that you were able to use your writing during that time to kind of keep the skill lively?
That's a really good question. Yes, there were. I wrote a lot of poetry. I wrote a lot of poetry because I could concentrate on it for just that amount of time, and I could come back to it, and I could go back and forth with it. But I did. I wrote a lot of poetry, and so yeah, that's what I did, and that's kind of how I stayed in touch with language. Yeah, and also I have a real strong feeling. I mean, that something like that, something that you've had a great passion for, can go underground and resurface. I think that's a big possibility. And I think also for women's lives, because, we're the ones raising the children and we're the ones taking care of the home, in general. I hope not completely anymore, but in general, that's kind of how it works. For women's lives, that's a really important concept, I think. That these passions that we have can become quiet and then can blossom again for us. Yeah, I think it's possible, and I know it's possible, and I think they're there for us when we have time and space and quiet.
So, what made you want to write such autobiographical works?
I hate to admit it, but I have no imagination whatsoever. I
Okay,
mean,
fair enough.
I must have some imagination because obviously this is all made up. I
Right,
mean, I don't
right.
have like a reel, I don't have journals, I don't have notebooks, I'm not taking notes. This is all constructed. So I do have that kind of imagination. But also, I have a really a reflective mind. I reflect a lot, and I try to take from what I've experienced and integrate it into my life. And these books are part of that work. I heard a woman, oh, I can't think of her name right now, but she's a priest in the Cheyenne tradition. And she said that an elder once told her that if you can't take your experiences and
and like make them part of your life, you are a dilettante. I heard this recently and I just thought it was so fascinating because I was like, I get that. I want to use the experiences I've had to understand life in a bigger way. And that's why, I think that's why I'm drawn to this kind of work.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you worry about how other people who might recognize themselves in your books will react?
Sometimes I do, but I have waited a long time. Anyone who would have an issue with my first book has died. I really waited until my parents, I think I waited until my parents had passed away, only because I had no intention of hurting their feelings. You know, I that just wasn't on my plate. That would have been terrible, and I wouldn't have done it. And it probably was one of the things that made me back away from writing earlier on, because I had these stories to tell and I knew I needed to look deeply into them. But with my parents living, I wasn't willing to hurt their feelings like that. So yeah, so that kind of is how that has gone.
Now, did you have a brother too?
Yes, yes. He had passed away as well by that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. When you started working on this again, so you get the manuscript out of the drawer, or it was maybe, was it in a computer form that you could resuscitate at that point, or was it on a floppy disk that you no longer could read?
Oh, no, I had it on paper, mm-hmm, in a bin, and my husband brought it up to me, you know, here's this. I just said, get that away from me. I'm not going to look at it. I don't want to see it. This is new. This is me now writing it, not me then writing it. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge difference, a huge, huge difference for
me.
So
you didn't take that original manuscript and rework it. You started over.
Oh yeah, no, I didn't want to even look at it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, as we get older, we gain a lot. We gain a lot as we get older. I mean, you know this, we gain so much empathy, both for ourselves and for other people. We gain so much understanding about like what the pressures of the world are and how they shape us in so many ways. So you don't want to go, for me as a writer, I don't want to go back to something I wrote when I was 25, when I'm 60. When I'm 60, I want everything I have as a 60-year-old to come to the front, you know. So
makes great sense. Mm-hmm. How did you find your publisher for that book?
Well, I have a husband who's a writer, and so I sent my manuscript to his publisher, and there was he didn't take the book, but he gave me advice on it. And then there was someone in his company who was very interested in the book, a woman, Andrea Walker, who has been a great editor for me along the way. So she was very interested in my writing and in the story. And so so then I had my agent and my publisher.
Okay, not everybody has those connections, so you're very fortunate in that way. But mm-hmm. You make it sound so easy. Was it really that easy?
Oh no, it wasn't easy. I mean, no. I mean, the first conversation I had, I mean, I wasn't discouraged. Let me just say that I wasn't discouraged, and so I worked on it for a couple more years, and then turned it in again. And, you know, it's the same with this one. I mean, I turned it in a number of times and worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. And, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy, but you have to love it. That's the thing, you know. Yeah.
Now, is your husband one of your, does he read as you're writing and give you feedback?
Not as I'm writing, but I should say yes, as I'm writing, but not as I'm writing. It's more, when I have a draft that I feel like I'm at the end of my understanding of, then I can give it to him and he can give me some feedback. Yeah, but there are.
Do you have other people that you do that with?
I do. I have a couple of friends from graduate school who I do that with. I kind of will do it also with my sister, just because she's part of this story, and I want her feedback on it. I think that's about it. And my agent, who I adore, I give it to her too, and she's a really good reader for me.
Now, do your children read what you've written?
They do, but I've told them with this one not to read it until it's in hard copy, which it is now. So now they can read it. There were some changes I'd made toward the end of the book when it was in galleys. So though I gave them a galley, I said, don't read it until it's out for real.
Do they know kind of your personal history that is in this book?
Not in this kind of detail, no. Mm. In general, yes. But, you know, they're grown women now, and it's just lovely to have the relationship we have. They're both writers.
Really? Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, so do they write autobiographical material?
No, not at all. I think our older daughter is a TV writer, so she writes a lot of TV and a lot of science fiction stuff, and so she's a really creative writer. Very imaginative. And our younger daughter writes essays, and she's a really amazing essay writer. She's just so insightful in what she sees happening around her. So, yeah, wow. So that's our family.
So I know. When you get together, do you like all exchange manuscripts?
Well, sometimes. We definitely talk about writing a lot. It's like one of the things of like being in the family of a shoemaker, you know how to make shoes by the time you grow up. And yeah.
And you have the feeling that writing is something you can do for a living, because for a lot of people that doesn't seem real, you know?
Yes. It's, I'm not sure it is real. Yeah, I mean, our younger daughter works at a bookstore, so she has a regular job. And I think that one of the things that we find that young people kind of don't understand or really have a maybe not exactly right idea about is that you're going to be able to, you know, go to school and then come out and be a writer and make your living, which just isn't the case. I mean, you know, my husband and I worked jobs. You know, right. We worked jobs and we tried to write, and that's how art works now. You know, you have to have your job to make your living. We had a young family, and you have to have your job and try somehow to find time to do your art, or do like I did and wait till your kids are grown up and then go back to it. So
what's your writing schedule look like now, or your writing routine look like now?
I generally get up and get started writing maybe about 9-10 o'clock. That's when I get started writing, and then I just work probably until about, I'll stop and have lunch, and I work until about 2-2:30, sometimes 3, depending on what I'm working on. And right now between books I'm not doing any writing, though I did write a children's book right after I finished this book. So that's
are you the person who writes very quickly, or someone who sort of takes are you a plotter or a pantser, I guess? So you write by the seat of your pants, get to the end, and then go back and rewrite, or you take care over every sentence before you move to the next one?
Oh, I maybe am in the middle, but I'm more like a seat of the pants person, where I write along, but I'm really meticulous about rewriting. I'm an obsessive rewriter. I rewrite endlessly. So that's really, I mean, that whole phrase, you know, writing is rewriting.
Yes.
That applies to me. I'm a rewriter more than I'm a writer.
When you set out, like when you start in the morning, do you start by reworking previous day's work, or do you start with a blank page each day?
No, not a blank page. No, I'll start with the work that I'm working on, and then it'll develop from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you know when you're done with the rewriting.
Oh, gosh, are you ever done? I don't know. I mean, I could probably rewrite this right now. I don't know. I suppose you know when you're done, when you get the feedback that people are getting the story that you want them to have.
Yeah.
You've told that you've said what you've wanted to say. Maybe. Yeah.
Well, Paula, I want to thank you for being with us today. I know we had a little bit of technical difficulty, but I think everything's working out okay.
Great. And thank you.
And do you have any like words of advice for somebody who wants to write a novel?
Okay. Let's see. Well, I do. And I'm going to take it back to the title of this novel, Starting From Here, because I liked this title because, you know, this young girl had to start from a place so far away from where she needed to go. So she's starting from South Dakota. She's trying to get to be a classical ballet dancer. That's really tough. But at the beginning of the book, she's at the beginning of her journey. And at the end of the book, she's at the beginning of her journey. So my advice for anyone trying to write a novel is to really understand that you're, no matter who we are and what we're doing, it doesn't matter what kind of our creativity we're expressing, we're always at the beginning of our journey. And so that's a nice thing to keep in mind and helps you, I think, not to get discouraged. You're always at the beginning. You're always ready to start fresh because there's no other way to start. You're at the beginning no matter where you are.
And it's never too late to start.
And it's never too late.
From wherever you are.
From wherever you are, exactly. Yeah, I think that's a nice idea. It's helpful.
We always close with a quote related in some way to the book. And the one I picked out for you today is from Agnes DeMille, who wrote, "To dance is to be out of yourself, larger, more beautiful, more powerful. This is power. It is glory on earth, and it is yours for the taking."
Oh, I love that. I'm so honored. That's so beautiful. Thank you, Monica. That is beautiful.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.